The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
My apologies on the Greek quiz, which I realized that you would have thought you had an hour, and there are a few of you who were a little pressured at the end, so I made a few adjustments in the grading. But we're going to be talking about chapter 12 today. At least we'll get to it. Remember, we devoted one lecture to each of the first four chapters. Then we ended up having a lecture each for chapters 5 and 6 together and chapters 7 and 8 together. Now we have to be even more selective since the end of the semester is approaching. And it looks like we're skipping four chapters, but can't really do it. If we want to do justice even to chapter 12 itself, and we're going to be focusing on the, beginning with about verse 20, and especially what happens after verse 37, because that very last paragraph looks like a summary of Jesus' public ministry. But it would be a serious mistake, I think, to ignore the three rather substantive and extensive chapters that precede chapter 12. After all, the summary at the end of chapter 12 really provides a climax to the whole section beginning with chapter 9. Remember, in the outline that I gave you, I had that titled the World's Unbelief. And when you get to that section beginning with verse 37 especially, it is very clear that we're giving a summary. That word doesn't really do justice to it. It's an evaluation of the character of Jesus' ministry as people have failed to respond to that ministry. But this notion of unbelief and rejection, which you will recall, you begin to get a sense of that early on, a little bit more explicitly in chapter 5. But it's beginning with chapter 9 that it becomes the focus. So what I want to do, take some good bit of time today to talk about chapters 9 through 11 as a background, if you will, to the passage I will be spending more time on. What are some of the characteristics of the section? Well, you might note, first of all, that when you get to chapter 9 and you look at that narrative, beginning with chapter 9, you no longer find an emphasis on Jesus' geographical movements. Remember, at least in the outline that I gave you, I kept highlighting Cana and Jerusalem and Cana and Galilee and back to Jerusalem and so on. That doesn't happen anymore. And you might say, well, of course, because this change in the construction of the narrative is just dictated by the realities of Jesus' life. He's no longer going to Cana and Galilee and whatever. True. But I think it's still significant to take note of this factor because, say, if you go to Luke's so-called travel narrative, remember at the end of chapter 9, Luke says, and then he set his face to go to Jerusalem, and that kind of provides an overarching concern for quite a few chapters that follow, 10 through 19 or so. And this is peculiar to the Gospel of Luke. I mean, both Matthew and Mark, after Jesus leaves Galilee, when you read it, it sounds like a fairly short trip that may have taken place just before the Passover when Jesus was crucified, the Passion Week. Luke, however, devotes a great deal of attention to it. You know, many of the well-known parables of Luke appear in this section, the story of Martha and Mary and all that. And the distinct impression given by that section is that Jesus didn't simply stay put in Jerusalem. From Tabernacles, chapter 7 of John, around September, let's say, from Tabernacles all the way to the Passover, Jesus didn't stay put there. Any way of harmonizing the Gospels or any way of trying to come up with a reasonable chronological framework would tell you that here's one way of thinking about it. The feeding of the 5,000 takes place around Passover time. John is explicit about that. In the Synoptics, that feeding of the 5,000 is sort of a prelude to Jesus retiring from the crowds and eventually going to Caesarea Philippi, and you have the transfiguration subsequent to that and so on, so that it is reasonable to think of those last events in the Galilean ministry as taking place, say, during the summer of that year. Then we have the information in the Synoptics that Jesus leaves Galilee to go to Jerusalem, and that presumably corresponds in some way to chapter 7 of John, Jesus going to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles. And now that leaves you a six-month period from the Feast of Tabernacles, John 7, to the Passover. And that is presumably where you have to put that long travel section in the Gospel of Luke. And it is clear from that travel section that Jesus is ministering in around Judea, Perea. And all I'm saying is that during this period, from chapter 7 of John until we get to chapter 12, Jesus is not simply in Jerusalem. And yet, John does not call attention to the places where he's going. Now, there is a hint in John itself, but only in the vaguest of terms, that Jesus was moving about during this period. For example, in chapter 10, let's take a quick look at it. Verse 40, this is after the controversy with the Jews where they tried to seize him, and once again he escapes their grasp. Verse 40 of chapter 10, then Jesus went back across the Jordan to the place where John had been baptizing in the early days, and here he stayed, and many people came to him. That's very vague. There's not even a specific name for a locale. The only explicit reference to any place, really, is the village of Ephraim, and that you have in chapter 11, verse 54. So my point is that John has already indicated in chapter 7 that Jesus makes this journey to Jerusalem, and now he shows no more interest in giving geographical locations. And that may have some significance in terms of how he sees the character of Jesus' ministry, how it has developed, particularly in terms of the opposition. I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. So that's the first characteristic, no longer an emphasis on geographical movement. Second, with regard to John's concern with the Jewish religious calendar and the feasts and so on, that concern continues. It continues to play a role in the narrative. In chapter 9, you have the description of the controversy, which has to do with the Sabbath, for example. John also makes a point of noting of noting that Jesus took part in the Feast of Hanukkah. Chapter 10. That passing reference is interesting, by the way, and has all kinds of possible implications. One that you might not think about, but it just came up yesterday. I was involved in a worship committee meeting where, you know, the problem of the regulative principle of worship in Reformed theology, that which is not commanded is prohibited, at least with regard to the elements of worship. And one argument against the regulative principle is that the Feast of Hanukkah is not prescribed in Scripture. Obviously, you know, it was instituted during the Maccabean period when Judas regained the temple and so on. And yet Jesus apparently participates in the Feast of Hanukkah. And so one argument goes, it appears that Jesus didn't pay attention to the regulative principle or something like that. Well, it's not quite as simple as that, but it is an interesting question and how to integrate that into other concerns. But as you read the passage, you know, there toward the end of chapter 10, as I say, it's just a passing reference. And what would, you know, motivate John to mention it at all, except once again to call attention to the Jewish character of what is going on and to highlight, therefore, the contrast between the old era, if you will, and the new order that Jesus initiates. So in this section, you have the Sabbath, you have the Feast of Dedication or Hanukkah, and then also, of course, the Passover at the end of 11, beginning of 12. A third characteristic, the theme of opposition. You remember that concern becomes increasingly prominent in the previous section, 5 through 8, and especially in chapter 7 and 8. I made a big point of that last time. But now it takes on a more fundamental role, and by that I mean, you remember that chapter 8 ends with an explicit reference to the Jews' attempt to take Jesus' life. The first time that, you know, previous references, you know, had spoken of their wanting to take his life or whatever, but this one says they actually picked up the stones and were ready to stone him. And surely that has to be taken seriously in terms of the development of the narrative. Now, that opposition has come to, you know, it's to the end, if you will. They are determined now, some of them anyway, to kill him. And that provides a transition for this new section beginning with chapter 9. So having established the Jewish rejection of Jesus' ministry, chapters 9 and 12 illustrate how their unbelief manifested itself. And that's why I use that heading, the world's unbelief, for chapters 9 through 12, because that is the overarching theme. It is the pervasive concern of those four chapters. Now, here's where I was suggesting that maybe there is a connection between this point and the lack of geographical references in this section of the gospel. I don't want to make too much of this, but I cannot help wondering whether what's going on is Jerusalem becomes the focal point of the opposition. Now that Jesus has reached Jerusalem in a more definitive sense, it also means that you have reached the final stage of the opposition in a definitive sense. There's no more going about to Cana and Galilee and so on, because that final stage of opposition, rejection, and therefore Jesus' death has taken place. Fourth characteristic. it's another theme that connects chapters 9 through 11 with what precedes, namely the theme of light, the theme of light. Most commentators, I believe, see the healing of the blind man in chapter 9, the healing of the blind man in chapter 9, as exemplifying Jesus' claim in chapter 8 that he is the light of the world. In other words, the blind man is in darkness, and Jesus gives him sight, and now he sees the light. This concern with the light, Jesus is the light, which first comes up in the prologue and then becomes explicit in chapter 8, reappears again a couple of times. For instance, in chapter 11, after the disciples said to Jesus, a short while ago the Jews tried to stone you and you're going back there to Judea. In verse 9, Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? A man who walks by day will not stumble, for he sees by this world's light. It is when he walks by night that he stumbles, for he has no light." So John is not forgetting that theme as he develops a narrative. And then again, in chapter 12, verse 35, then Jesus told them, "You are going to have the light just a little while longer. Walk while you have the light before darkness overtakes you. The man who walks in the dark does not know where he is going. Put your trust in the light while you have it, so that you may become sons of light." So, I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that as you seek to understand what's happening in chapters 9 through 11, one of the things to keep in mind is the way in which John is relating the narrative here with what has preceded. And even though I'm in my outline, I make a separate section of chapters 9 through 12, we cannot forget the connections here. Now, that connection, you know, might tempt you to think that the two chapters, that is 8 and 9, ought not to be separated. And I don't recall offhand whether there are commentators who, in fact, structurally link chapters 8 and 9 more closely than I have done. I have resisted doing that because, you see, the connection between the theme of light in 8 and the giving of sight in 9, though I think it is a real connection, I think that's real, it is nevertheless only implicit. And what I mean by that is that in the description of the healing of the blind man, the actual vocabulary of darkness and light, that's not the way in which it is described, you see. And so it's a little subtle, perhaps. It's, I think, secondary or implicit. Whereas, in chapter 9, the element of rejection becomes the focus. That's what really comes at you as the reader. And that focus is expanded in chapter 10. Now, there are some people who separate 9 and 10 because, you have this extended discourse in chapter 10, which looks on the surface as being quite different from what's going on in chapter 9. In chapter 9, you have a blind man healed on the Sabbath, leading to controversies and so on. In chapter 10, you have discussion about the door and the shepherd and the sheep. And at first, it looks a little bit distinct. But I think it is a grave mistake to separate those two chapters. They are a unit, and a unit distinct from what precedes. But I think you can recognize that, and at the same time recognize that here we have one more instance of the kind of overlapping themes between sections, and material that tends to bridge one section with another section. I think that's what's going on, as you see this thematic relationship between the theme of light in chapter 8 and the healing of the blind man in chapter 9. A fifth characteristic is the very strong connection between chapters 11 and 12. Now, again, in my outline, whereas I brought together 9 and 10 as a subheading, I left separate 11 and 12 as two distinct subsections. But that does not mean that the two chapters are not structurally related. In fact, Dodd, who also separates the two chapters formally in his outline, seems to recognize how closely connected they are, because we just look at the titles he gives to them. Chapter 11 he entitles The Victory of Life Over Death. Of course, Lazarus is being given life, The Victory of Life Over Death. And then his title for chapter 12 is Life Through Death, The Meaning of the Cross. Life Through Death, The Meaning of the Cross. And he notes that in chapter 11, you have a summons to go to Judea because Lazarus is sick. And that summons is expressed in the context of the purpose of that being that the glory may be manifested. Look at chapter 11, verse 4. When he heard this, namely the message that Lazarus was sick, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." So the request for Jesus to come to Judea is being interpreted here as having as its purpose the manifestation of God's glory in an act of life-giving, the giving of life. You see this again in, let's see. Oh, just a second. Now, Dodd goes on to say that it is therefore also a summons to face death, and that is exactly the way the disciples understand it. You remember that in verse 11, Jesus tells the disciples, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up." His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. Let us go to him." Then Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." So the point is that the disciples are understanding this request of going to Judea as having at least its result, if not its purpose, the facing of death. Then Dodd goes on to say this. This is on page 367 of his book on the interpretation of the fourth gospel. "Thus, the narrative before us is not only the story of dead Lazarus raised to life, it is also the story of Jesus going to face death in order to conquer death. In the previous episode, in chapter 10, we were told that the good shepherd comes to give life to his flock, and that in doing so, he lays down his life for the sheep. The episode we're now considering, Lazarus, conforms exactly to that pattern. The good shepherd comes to give life to his flock, and in so doing, he lays down his life for the sheep." So the connection between 10 and 11 becomes a little bit clearer, except that now the theme of life coming in some way associated with death becomes a little bit more prominent, and it really surfaces in chapter 12. Anyway, the connection between the death and resurrection of Lazarus in chapter 11 and Jesus' own death becomes structurally explicit at the end of chapter 11, where you have a sequel to the resurrection of Lazarus, in regard to the plot of the Jews to kill Jesus. And this also serves as something of a transition, because look at verse 49, 11:49. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. "You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish." He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. So what I'm saying is that structurally, by inserting this sequel, which serves as a transition, John is explicitly linking what has just happened in giving life to Lazarus, linking that with Jesus' own death. Conversely, when you get to chapter 12, John doesn't want you to forget what he has just told you in chapter 11. And so we have repeated references to Lazarus that almost seem monotonous and redundant. But John cannot afford for you to lose sight of the link between these two passages. And so, verse 1 of chapter 12, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrived at Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead, as though we might have forgotten that already. Then verse 2, here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Again, verse 9. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. And then once again in verse 17, now the crowd that was with him had continued to spread the word that he had called Lazarus from the tomb, raising him from the dead. And again, thematically, and I suppose more than thematically, theologically, John wants you to understand what's happening here in chapter 12, and I think especially the passage that we're going to be looking at more directly, beginning with verse 20, as something that needs to be understood in connection with the death of Lazarus and his being brought back to life. Well, so much for the characteristics of the narrative of chapters 9 through 11 as a background to chapter 12. What about the content of these chapters? How does that content advance the argument of the gospel as a whole? Well, they're very rich narratives, as I'm sure you realize. It's kind of difficult to summarize the material briefly. But let me just highlight a number of things. From a dramatic point of view, if you're interested in the dramatic character of the composition of the Gospel of John, chapter 9 is clearly a high point. It's clearly a high point in the Gospel. There are, needless to say, you know, several, I would say five or six stories in the Gospel of John that are very dramatic. I think that if we were to have a competition or something, 9 probably, I mean, it has certain qualities that you just can't miss or not be moved by it. For one thing, it echoes the narrative of chapter 5. Remember we talked about that. You have the same pattern of a story that takes place on the Sabbath. There's a healing that leads, and it is because it is on the Sabbath, that leads to controversy with the Jews. So that as you read chapter 9, consciously or unconsciously, it just brings back some echoes from what you had read a few chapters earlier. This narrative includes, I think, the most biting irony in the whole of the Gospel. I'm thinking especially in the dialogue that begins with verse 27. You remember that they come back to, that the Pharisees come back to the blind man. Let's go to verse 24. A second time they summon the man. You remember why? Because they have gone to talk to his parents, and the parents, you know, confirm certain things, but they cannot satisfy the curiosity of the Pharisees. So a second time they summoned the man who had been blind. "Give glory to God," they said. "We know this man is a sinner." He replied, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see." And, I mean, right there when you read that, you know that we have a kind of an interesting dynamics beginning to develop here. A commoner, to put it mildly, who perhaps is a little hesitant and intimidated by these Jewish leaders. And so it sounds like he doesn't want to get into an argument here. Say, "Well, you may be right, but I'll tell you, here's what happened. And I cannot argue with that." You know. Then they asked him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered, now he's getting impatient, you see. "I have told you already, and you didn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too?" And now this is getting even more interesting. You know this isn't going to end there. So they get a little upset. They hurl insults at him and say, "You are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from." And then we have, this is the biting irony of this man proceeds to give him a theological discourse, you know, a brief discourse, but it's very pointed. Now, that is remarkable. "You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly man who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." He had been perhaps a little hesitant to speak his mind, but now he comes out very clearly. And as a result, they excommunicate him. "You were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us?" And they threw him out. Very powerful. And in addition to all of this, the whole story concludes with a theological statement that really sounds the depths of the mystery of the coming of Christ and the way that people respond to him. I'm talking about the very end of the chapter, where verse 39, Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world." Now, we've heard that before. But then he says, "So that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this and asked, "What, are we blind too?" Now, it's not immediately clear what motivates this question. I mean, you could read this a couple of different ways. What may be the apparent reading is that after Jesus has said, "So that those who see will become, so that those who are blind will see, those who see will become blind," that Jesus is accusing the Pharisees of being blind. However, which is perhaps not as likely, but I sometimes have wondered about this, whether the Pharisees are saying, "Are we blind too?" with the indication, which means that we will be made to see, because Jesus has made this contrast, the ones who are really, who will be saved, are those who are blind. And so they're asking, which category do we belong to? Well, regardless of how you interpret the question of the of these Jews, Jesus' response is what really matters here. If you were blind, then you'd be in good shape. Why? Because you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains. This is really what a remarkable way of putting it. And it, I think it represents one of the fundamental themes in the Synoptic Gospels, which sometimes has caused a little bit of debate. For example, when Jesus makes a statement in the Synoptics, a physician doesn't come to those who are healthy, but to heal those who are sick, in the same way the Son of Man has come to seek and save those save those who are lost, seek and save those who are lost. There is some debate in the literature among scholars whether that should be taken in an ironic way or not. Those who are well do not need a physician. Does Jesus really mean that about the Pharisees, or is it purely a sarcastic comment? Well, I think this makes it very plain. The problem is not that the Pharisees, at least the ones that he's addressing or whatever, are well, but that they claim to be well. And John makes that explicit here. It's not that the Pharisees truly see, but that they claim they can see. And they remain, their guilt remains so long as they don't acknowledge blindness. And that is why the publicans and the sinners are ahead of them. Because in spite of their apparently more sinful behavior, when they acknowledge their blindness, they are not well, they need a physician. They are lost, they need to be found. They are blind, they need to be given sight. That is the key to having that guilt of sin removed. But because these claim to see, their guilt remains. Now, there is no break in the narrative here. You go straight into the discourse, and there's no suggestion whatsoever either of a different setting or of any time having elapsed. And that's why I think it's very important to read chapter 10 as a true continuation of this remarkable statement. If you were blind, your guilt remains. And so what you find in chapter 10 is not simply, if you will, the nice, beautiful comments about the sheep hearing his voice. That's true enough. But more basic to that discourse is the polemic against these people who ought to be shepherds to the sheep. But they have been unfaithful to that responsibility. So when he says, I tell you the truth, the man who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate but climbs in by some other way is a thief and a robber, that sets the stage for everything else. It's telling you what is the primary focus of the discourse. The man who enters by the gate is the shepherd of his sheep. The watchman opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And then he continues with that metaphor. And then verse 6, Jesus used this figure of speech, but they didn't understand what he was telling them. Why? Because they're blind. And so the theme of misunderstanding is once again brought to bear. Therefore, Jesus said again, apparently intent in confusing them even more, because now he starts mixing metaphors. I tell you the truth, I am the gate for the sheep. Now, if you look at many standard critical commentaries on the Gospel of John, you will find a fairly a strong consensus among many of them that you have two separate and disparate discourses that simply do not make sense together. I mean, he's either the gate or he's the shepherd, but he can't be both, you see. And so somebody has at some point mixed these two together and left a quite a confusing picture. I guess I marvel in some ways at that kind of analysis of the material, because how in the world can you account for the beauty and power of the Gospel of John while at the same time assessing these kinds of details as a total blunders, you know, from a literary point of view? Psychologically, it doesn't make an awful lot of sense. I mean, the dissonance, if you will, between Jesus just having said that, in so many words, really, that he's the shepherd of the sheep, and immediately saying, "I am the gate for the sheep," that dissonance would have been so obvious to anybody that it simply does not make sense to think that they just fumbled it in some way. It's got to be deliberate, is what I'm getting at. And maybe in an odd sort of way, it actually has the total effect of bringing the material home even more powerfully than if you had maintained a nicely developed metaphor without any apparent problems. In any case, I do think you have the deliberately mixed metaphors here, which look like an expansion of the shepherd material in the Synoptic Gospels, and which leads eventually to one more strong predestinarian passage in this Gospel. And I'm talking about what happens beginning with verse 22. Then came the Feast of Dedication at Jerusalem. It was winter. Jesus was in the temple area walking in Solomon's colonnade. The Jews gathered around him, saying, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly." Jesus answered, "I did tell you, but you do not believe. The miracles I do in my Father's name speak for me, but you do not believe because you are not my sheep." Now, see, right there, you, I think, are expected by John to remember chapter 6. No one comes to me unless he's drawn by the Father. No one can come to me unless he's drawn by the Father. And all that the Father has given will come to me. Now the same concept is being re-expressed with the shepherd imagery and the sheep imagery. Verse 27, "My sheep listen to my voice. I know them, and they can follow me. I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish. No one can snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all. No one can snatch them out of my Father's hand. I and the Father are one." Now, I mean, this is something that you can sit and reflect and think about for 3 hours. And you slowly begin to appreciate the enormous amount of content that is being compressed here. Theme of perseverance, even more powerful than in Old Mother Hubbard. I give them, just the language used here, you know, "I give them eternal life and they shall never perish." If you do not believe in perseverance of the saints, or whatever you want to call it, then this is a peculiar eternal life we're talking about. You know, eternal life that lasts only insofar as, whatever. But they shall never perish. No one can snatch them out of my hand. You bring this up to somebody who does not believe in perseverance as well, but you see, you can kind of squeal your own way out of the hand, you see. In other words, God protects you from your enemies and your opponents and so on, but it's still kind of up to you and whether it happens or not. And again, I have to say, what kind of protection is it that doesn't protect me from myself? That's the only one that matters to me, frankly. But of course, all of this is in the context of a much broader understanding of what salvation looks like in the Gospel of John. Because the doctrine of the perseverance of the saints or the eternal security of the believer, whatever, is one that, as you well know, there are many Christian groups who do like and accept and affirm and whatever, but they're not quite willing to view it in the context of other elements of, you know, biblical teaching regarding God's grace that are absolutely, I think, unavoidable if you want to have this one. Now, this is not a course on soteriology, and I'm not going to try to bring out all those connections, but it really is a travesty to read, you know, this passage and say, oh yeah, you know, we're there forever, and not take it in the context of these other things that Jesus has said, which alone make this a meaningful promise. No one can come to the Father unless come to me unless the Father draw him. That is what gives the foundation to the promise of perseverance. But in addition to all this, you have this remarkable equation of Jesus with the Father. It isn't just that last comment in verse 30, I and the Father are one, but the way in which he pairs his own protection with that of the Father's protection. In verse 28, no one can snatch them out of my hand. Verse 29, no one can snatch them out of my Father's hand. That parallelism, not just the fact that he calls the Father, Father, but that parallelism of this functional equivalence almost, is absolutely incredible. And you cannot blame the Jews for thinking that Jesus was making himself equal with the Father. As they say in verse 33, we're not stoning you for your miracles, whatever, but for blasphemy, because you, a mere man, claim to be God. So this is a pretty significant section as you're trying to identify the way in which the argument of the gospel is progressing. It's one more, you know, climactic wave, if you will, if you try to visualize the way in which the narrative develops. It's a very, very important one. still want to say some things about chapter 11 before we move on to the focal point, but do you have any questions about 9 and 10? Yeah. Oh, no, I didn't have that in mind. And I'm not sure that I can put my finger on it. What I'm saying is, it does not sound reasonable that someone who's responsible, I mean, whether you think of in terms of an original author or redactor or whatever, who can put together something as powerful as this book, can make such an incredible blunder, if indeed it is a blunder. And that therefore it makes a lot better sense to view it as some kind of deliberate, what appears to be dissonance. And that in some way that metaphorical dissonance has the effect of bringing home to the reader in a more powerful way the richness of what is going on here. I'm not sure. I mean, there are various ways in which people have tried to deal with that mixing of metaphors. But Yeah. I am not aware of any significant parallels to this kind of moving from one to the other. But I mean, that's an interesting possibility that, except that it starts with I am the gate. No. It's, see, this is part of the difficulty. He doesn't begin making a specific claim so much as pointing out the problem with these who claim to be leaders. Then there's the claim I am the gate, and then the claim I am the, more explicitly, the claim that I am the great shepherd. But it may be that, you know, yeah, this sense of total dependence on Jesus may be expressed by the accumulating of the metaphors. Yeah. That's, I guess I would tend to see that more in the light of, you know, 1 John. That's certainly an explicit concern. We're going to come back to this a little bit in chapter 12. I think the real motivating factor is explaining why the Jewish people and the Jewish leaders have not come to Jesus. I think that's the dominating concern. But yeah, it is possible that something else is going on here.